Welcome to the Peak Mental Performance Podcast with Joe Shalero, optimizing your mental health and athletic performance one episode at a time.
All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Peak Mental Performance Podcast. I have with me today Mike Tuchscherer. He is an IPF World Champion powerlifter who began training back in 1997, has set various IPF world records, has competed in both single ply and raw divisions. Mike is also a very experienced coach and the owner of Reactive Training Systems. And a lot of the things that he does with his coaching over there, we're going to talk about today and how it feeds into some of our topics. So thanks for taking the time to do this today, Mike.
Oh, happy to be here.
Absolutely. So kind of to get started, I think there's probably some people who are very familiar with what you do and some of the things that I think a lot of people recognize you for the implementation of RPE into your training. But for some of the people who maybe aren't as familiar with what you do at RTS and your training style, can you give people an idea of kind of what your approach to training is and how that kind of feeds into how you coach?
So the training process that we use has been the training process for kind of a long time, but you do these things before you have a way to articulate it a lot of times. But lately, the thing that kind of sticks out in my mind that we do that's probably different from what a lot of people do is just the radical individualization of training. That I see lifters that have different responses to different training stimulus all the time. So it's about how do we modify a training program so that it's the best that it can be for this specific individual person. You know, like if you look at any training study where they have people doing pretty much the same training, you get a wide spread of responses, you know. And so you can look at these a lot of times, and I think the best use for, you know, exercise science and things like that is to kind of expand on the general principles. This is generally what happens. This is generally the direction that you want to go. But if you're one of these outlier people, then that doesn't help you very much. You know, you need to figure out what it is that moves you toward your goals, what moves you toward the outcomes that you're looking for in training. And as a coach, those general things are really useful. But when it comes down to applying them to a specific individual, you've got to keep in mind that the thing that individual cares about is their own progress. Not, well, this works for most people, you know, like that doesn't help them very much if it doesn't work for them.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I think, you know, you make some, even just in those few sentences, you make some great points about, you know, these general principles certainly apply to the majority of lifters, but how they're applied definitely depends on the person. And I think sometimes, at least what I've noticed in my time in powerlifting, is I think people forget that there's kind of almost a natural selection process that happens with a lot of different really successful gyms and crews where, you know, the people will be like, well, everything, this worked for everybody there. And what I think people forget to factor in is, well, there's probably some people it didn't work for and then they left the gym. So sometimes we have to be critical about, you know, there's definitely great clues to take from everywhere, but we have to always keep in mind the context of who that population is and things like that.
Well, I really like that point because it applies to online coaching as well. I was talking with, name drop a little bit, I was talking with Eric Helms about this somewhat recently, and it's like if someone signs up for coaching with me, like I've been around long enough, they know in a lot of ways what they're going to get. Mm-hmm. You know, so the people who are not at all attracted to that type of training probably aren't going to sign up for training with me. So there's a little bit of a selection bias if we just look at our own client populations, you know, and you see that in all different walks, right? Like if you tend to be a very, you like your programming very simple and everybody pretty much starts along the same lines and you focus on these limited number of things. And like, if that's your style, then over time, that's what you become known for, and you attract people that on the bubble prefer that kind of training style. So, you know, you've been coaching for, you know, 5-6 years at that point, and you go, well, this works for everybody that I've ever trained, you know, or 90% of the people I've ever trained. Well, you're not working with a population that's reflective of the powerlifting population at large at that point, you know? So you're absolutely right. That sort of selection bias is something that's really important to keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's just a lot of value to, you know, playing devil's advocate to all of our own ideas and the things that we do with coaching for that reason. And especially in something like powerlifting, where in terms of different sports, even outside of powerlifting, when you look at how different populations are a little bit segmented in powerlifting. So say, you know, you have certain people depending on what federation they're competing in or what divisions they're competing in are naturally going to kind of get segmented a little bit. So I think it's always good for us to be mindful of, you know, if we're always kind of working with one population, to keep in that mind in the context of like, oh, this idea has worked for the last 5 years of me working with people, but just keeping that in mind of who I'm working with.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So as I mentioned before, I think commonly a lot of people know that your use of radiant perceived exertion in your training and things like that, but kind of a broader concept of just auto-regulation and as you mentioned a little bit, individualization with clients. Can you talk a little bit for people who maybe aren't familiar with what auto-regulation is and why you think that's important to people in their training?
Sure. So I would say that auto-regulation is the planned correction to a training process. So everyone starts out with a training plan, or at least you should. And ideally, we want that to be as good of a plan as we can start with. There's no way, no matter how good the plan is, that things will go 100%. And you're making those adjustments yourself based on your own experience and what you see, that's also an auto-regulated process. It's less regimented, it's less structured, but it's still the same sort of thing. It's like, well, we have this plan, but we're going to tweak it a little bit as we go. That's all making course corrections to that, to the training plan. Now, if you have a plan and you don't intend to make any corrections to it, that's kind of the opposite. That will be something that's not auto-regulated.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I think your description of it is really good, because I think at least in times that I've heard or read people talk about auto-regulation, sometimes I think there's a misconception that it's like just, and this may be the case with certain training methods, but you know, that people just go into the gym and just kind of, okay, what do I want to do today? And I think to your point, you know, it's course correcting on a plan. It's still planned, but you're making adjustments based on your performance as you're in there.
Exactly. It's not the whole Joe Weider instinctive training thing, right? There's a benefit to be gained from a certain amount of planning, you know, and that's maybe a whole other conversation, that it can go too far, for sure. And the more we plan, there's kind of an anchoring effect to it psychologically. The more we plan, the more reluctance we have to deviate from the plan. So there's definitely a sweet spot between having a plan and kind of knowing what we want to do, and, you know, having over planning, I guess, and causing that sort of anchoring effect. Yeah, but you definitely need to have some sort of a plan in place. If you walk into the gym and don't know what you're going to do, and let me take a step back and maybe clarify my position a little bit. What I mean by having a plan in place is that when I send my lifters to the gym, they need to know not only what exercises we're doing, but what the rep range is going to be, and what the target RPE is going to be, how many sets we're going to do, Even having target weights for those RPEs. So that's another misconception I think that pops up a lot with RPE-based training is that you walk in and you know triple nine RPE and I'm just going to totally feel it out. Well, it's I don't advocate that either because that leads to just wild variations in the loads that are used and kind of an overvaluing of your own emotional response of the moment. I think you're far better off to have a target weight in mind that's based on your past performances. And as you work up, the RPE structure allows you to deviate from that plan. So we need to start with the plan. And we know that I want to do 120 kilos for this many reps, you know, and it's going to be this RPE. And as I work up to that, I see, hey, I'm performing as expected today, so I'll stick to that plan. Or I'm not performing as expected, so I'm going to deviate from that plan, either up or down.
Yeah, it's and I think there's so much of that that's not only obviously, you know, conducive to the lifter getting stronger and being successful at their meet, but that's so much of a learning process too that I'm sure you see with a lot of people you work with that they, you know, in my mind, part of coaching, and I think sometimes this gets lost in the online coaching discussion sometimes, but, you know, I think the what you want is that people, after they do a training cycle with you, that they've learned more about themselves as a lifter. And I think autoregulation, like you're discussing, is a great opportunity to do that because they start to get a feel for the ebb and flow of training.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it can go – you can take that idea further as well, you know, and we've started to do that over the last couple of years now, I would say, even into auto-regulating things like the length of the training block and have like we've always talked about, like we coaches have always talked about learning what the lifter responds best to and individualizing things like exercise selection and stuff like that. But then it's always kind of met with a lot of hand waving and just, well, you just figure it out. I've, until somewhat recently, talking to some throws coaches about Bondarchuk style training and Dr. Bondarchuk's methodologies. I hadn't come across very much, well, here's the process of how you figure that stuff out, you know, and as we've started to implement those processes a lot more, we've had so much better, we've had much better results as far as separating the signal from the noise and figuring out, yes, this seems to be what this lifter is responding best to. And whenever we do these other things, the results are not so good. And there's more of a methodology behind it instead of so much reliance on, well, hopefully you're good at pattern recognition and you can just kind of tease this stuff out. Because especially with, I've noticed that a lot of coaches, especially intelligent coaches, like to use more complicated periodization schemes. And I think up to that point, it makes sense why that would happen. But the more complicated the structure of the training, the more noise is getting thrown in there and the harder it's going to be to figure out where the signal is. So I'm really kind of rambling off topic here, but no, the way that we've addressed a lot of this stuff is to simplify the training process a lot and simplify it as much as you can. So instead of meeting the complex responses of the human body with more complexity in your periodization scheme, you try to simplify it as much as possible. And that helps you to tease out what those signals are if you give it a little bit of time and are willing to pay attention to it.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think, you know, I've found that even, you know, there's so many, especially in powerlifting, as, you know, as we've gotten more access to more equipment and different things, there's so many variables. Even recovery techniques, there's so many variables we can include in a training program, and there's so many that are effective, but that's why I think one of the issues of, like, if you throw an entire table's worth of variables at somebody as a lifter, and then something, you see like a breakdown, when you realize how complex each breakdown is, it's like, now I have to identify out of this whole mess of variables I threw at them, which are the ones that are contributing to this, and that's where, yeah. You know, sometimes – it's like training that's quote unquote a little boring sometimes can be a positive thing, because then it's like, okay, well, if we keep the training simple, like to your point, now if we recognize an error where we have to make an adjustment, it's easier to tease out and reverse engineer what that error is versus if I have you doing 8 different special exercises with 4 different types of accommodating resistance and 3 different types of percentage schemes. And now it's like, well, it's a lot harder to sort through figuring out what the problem is.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And I mean, I would even say if you're wave loading your volumes or intensities week to week, well, that's an introduction of complexity right there, you know? And so at the end of the block, you go, well, that block didn't go so well. Well, why? You know, what is it about the stimulus that you didn't respond well to? And it seems like our response to this so far has been, well, crank more volume, you know, at least lately, that seems to have been the trend, you know, and it's funny, right? Like, if you were trying to make, say that making a training program is akin to writing a piece of music, you know, and you're trying to write this piece of music that just works, and you know when it's music versus when it's just noise, right? And so you make this piece of music and it doesn't quite work, you know, it's just doesn't sound real great, and so your response to it is, turn up the volume, you know? Well, yeah, okay, you're increasing the magnitude of the stimulus, and maybe in certain cases that can work, you know, but it's not the same thing as just, it doesn't solve the problem, you know?
Right.
You're just increasing the stimulus, you know? And I think it's a fairly short-sighted solution as well.
Oh, definitely. And I think there's, in that same theme, there's this value to taking an extra step back and looking at the bigger picture, even outside of your current training cycle or phase or wave or block or whatever, because I know something that I've especially lately been thinking about and wrote a little bit about was the idea of sometimes you don't realize the performance benefits of an area of training you do until obviously later. So, yeah. You know, you may have something where maybe while you were doing it, you're not hitting a ton of PRs, but then when you make some training adjustments and maybe reduce volume or, you know, adjust recovery techniques or something, you know, adjust frequency, then you start to kind of realize the benefits of that training you did in the past. I think it's common for lifters sometimes to be like, oh, see, now this works and that didn't. And it's like, well, maybe this is just the wave picking back up now of where your recovery's at and things too. So it's just such a bigger picture than I think we like to look at it sometimes as lifters.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you.
So, kind of to, with finishing up on the idea of some of the auto-regulation stuff, what do you think are some common mistakes people make with auto-regulation that you think if people are trying to include that in their training are important to try and not fall into?
Well, I suppose if we're going to limit it to RPE and RPE styles, one big problem is what I mentioned earlier, just not having a plan. If you don't have a good plan to deviate from, then, you know, you're doing the instinctive training thing again. And we figured out that isn't the way a long time ago. I mean, there are a lot of criticisms of RPE and that I would say come from misapplication of it. Another one that comes up from time to time is that I don't think you should be trying to rate your RPE in the middle of the set. You know, it's not like if you're on your way to a set of 5, you know, after the third rep, you go, was that a 9 yet? Fourth rep, is that a 9 yet? No, I would not advocate something like that. Instead, I would say, if you're supposed to do a set of 5, then do a set of 5. And unless you're just really bad at weight selection, you should get it, you know, and you may be off of your target RPE, but it's not going to be a catastrophe. After you put the bar down, that's the time to rate it. you know, as soon after you put the bar down as you can, you know, but you definitely want to execute the set and focus on that execution first. Don't get too hung up on, you know, if you're being accurate enough with your RPE. Be as accurate as you can be, but that's as good as you can do. And beyond that, you know, worrying about it doesn't really get you that much. I would say recognize it for what it is. It's a rating of your perception of the difficulty of that set, you know, relative to a maximum difficulty. And your perception might be wrong, but, you know, especially if you're an experienced lifter, chances are it's not wildly wrong, you know, and you can recognize that for what it is, that it's an assessment of your perception of difficulty. You know, if it's off by a little bit, then yeah, that can have some downstream consequences. But as a fundamental training metric, you do as well as you can with it and you get better with it over time. It's not unlike technique, you know. If you're going to start squatting and it's your first day in the gym, then there are some basics to learning the squat that are required, you know, some fundamental proficiency items, you know. And if you can't do those, then you need to go backwards in the progression. Maybe you just need to learn some basic movement stuff before you put a barbell on your back, right? But if you can meet these minimum requirements, then you go ahead and start squatting, right? That doesn't mean that you've mastered it. That means that you're proficient at it, you know, that you've met the minimum proficiency requirements. There's still a long way to go toward mastery. And I see RPE as being somewhat similar. If I had a beginner, I would have them practice rating their RPE. I was talking to a friend of mine just yesterday, I think, and he was telling me that he had a lifter he was coaching who was a beginner, you know, or a relative novice. He was training for his first powerlifting meet. He was training with percentages, but he had him practicing rating his RPE. And he was finishing these sets of six or something like that, and rating him like 8.5, 9 RPE. But he was watching them and he thought, man, that doesn't look like that. It looks like, you know, sub six. So one day he has him just do an AMRAP set, just keep going until you can't anymore. And he got like 23 reps, you know? So obviously he didn't meet those minimum proficiency requirements to use RPE in training, but that was obvious because he was a relative beginner. So he wasn't being trained with RPE. Now, once you can meet those minimum requirements, you can get pretty close most of the time. Then you can start training with RPE. That doesn't mean that you're done. You still have a lot more to go before you've really mastered it. And for me, even now, like, I've been doing this for a long time. And if I pick up a new movement or an exercise that I haven't done in a long time, my RPE judgments are going to be bad for the first couple sessions until I kind of figure out where those maximums are and what does it feel like to push this exercise. So it's always a learning process, and that's just something that you've got to get comfortable with.
Yeah, I think those are some great points, and I agree. Like you said, I think while everyone, you know, there's obviously a million ways to skin a cat, and while everyone might not use RPE, I think a lot of the criticisms are because of misapplication or misconceptions people have. But I think that goes a lot of different ways in powerlifting.
Sure. Yeah.
Kind of to your point too about this psychological impact of how different people perceive, maybe especially beginners perceive their RPE on, you know, how accurate that is. I know something you've been doing more of recently, of you did a survey on your site, and then I believe you presented on it, is the influence that people's personality types have on their training and programming. Can you talk a little bit about that? What sparked you to start kind of looking more into that?
Yeah. I mean, it kind of comes from a pretty typical place. We were kind of sitting around as coaches, and you hear this come up from time to time whenever coaches talk, just that it seems like there is a difference in response, in training response, between people of differing personality types. And that's really all the further that I've ever heard it go, you know, is just that. But we were talking about that one day, and I thought, I wonder if there's a way to quantify this a bit better. You know, so we were starting to think about it and put some things together, and we decided to run a Project Momentum on it, which Project Momentum is this test that we do periodically when we have a training question and we want to get some data and try to form an answer to it. So we put together this questionnaire, sent it out to as many people as would take it. And we ended up with 650 or so responses to this questionnaire. So a pretty good number of powerlifters responded to it. And in this questionnaire, we had them take a Big Five personality test. And we also had them tell us about their training. We asked them a number of questions about their training, in particular, the most effective training for them. So from that, we tried to narrow it down to only the most experienced and high-level lifters. The assumption that's built into this is that, you know, if you're a very experienced and high-level lifter, you must know something about what works best for you. You know, now that may or may not be a good assumption, but you've got to start somewhere. So right. that's where we started. Mm-hmm. And we came away with 128, I believe, respondents that met our criteria. And so of this highly experienced cohort, the average training age was something like 8 years, an average of a 425 Wilkes score, which is quite good. So it was a good sample that we got. And from that, we looked for correlations between personality and various training variables. So for example, do you prefer to train with higher RPEs or low RPEs? And we defined what those were. You know, we found that people who are higher in extroversion or higher in neuroticism tended to like to train with higher RPEs. People lower in those traits tended to prefer lower RPEs. You know, I would say that there definitely needs to be more. You would need to construct some different experiments to tease out, you know, if that's actually better for them or not, but that does seem to be their preference, you know, and a lot of that makes sense, right? So if you have somebody who's high in extroversion, they like that external stimulus, you know, so training with high RPEs meets that external stimulus craving, I guess you could say, that those people tend to feel. Same with people higher in neuroticism, those people tend to feel more negative emotions, so more fear, stress, and anxiety. And at first, that result didn't make sense to me. So why would people that feel more fear, stress, anxiety prefer to train with higher RPEs? It seems like that would be more stressful. But after talking with some people who are higher in neuroticism, what was explained to me was there's less ambiguity. You know, so if you do a set and it's a 10 RPE, then you know it's a 10. Whereas if it's a 7, then you go, man, I wonder if I should have added a little bit more weight. And you kind of have that second guessing effect. So that kind of makes sense. You know, so we found that with a lot of these different things, different traits, is that a lot of them kind of make sense. Some of them sort of do, or some of them really don't. But we've got a good starting point for where to look into this in more detail, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great idea. It's really interesting. A year or two ago, and a lot of what we do on this podcast too is get into mental health and lifters. And so it's kind of a different dimension or layer of what you're talking about. But I did a kind of a similar survey a couple years ago with lifters who had either been diagnosed or shown symptoms of mental health conditions and went into a bunch of variables that are training. It was really interesting to see these different links between, you know, things that people saw of like when they think training's going well, when they don't, when they, what types of things they feel burn them out, stuff like that. And I definitely think it's interesting to keep learning more about all that goes into that, because I think it's easy for people to dismiss a lot of that and be like, you know, especially I think with big group training is, you know, now just do this. And they feel like, well, why are they not able to recover from this? Person B can. And I think that a lot of those things, you know, factor into it. I mean, I think sometimes people forget how their psychological reception of something they're doing factors so much into how the impact that makes on their recovery.
Well, it's a little bit of a false dichotomy, isn't it? This separation that we have between, you know, the mental or the psychological and the physical. One thing that I thought was interesting as I started looking into personality more and more deeply is that there's a personality test called the TCI. I believe it's the Temperament and Character Inventory. And this measures different dimensions, but the dimensions are linked. And anyway, the factors of personality that it measures have been correlated to levels and sensitivities of neurotransmitters in the brain. So they don't measure things like extroversion, neuroticism. They would measure something that they, like, for example, if they typed you as, I'm going to blank on what the names are, but there's reward dependence, harm avoiders, and novelty seekers. So a novelty seeker has a little bit more, a little bit less sensitivity to dopamine in the brain. So they seek more external stimulus, a little bit more novelty to increase the levels of dopamine, so that's just how they are. You know, that's just their natural tendency. So to think of it as, well, that's just your psychology, you need to sort that out on your own. Like, well, that doesn't really address the true nature of the problem. You know, and if you start to say, hey, maybe a person's personality is a window that you can see their neurochemistry, and we all powerlifters tend to generally accept how important, you know, the nervous system is to powerlifting training. You know, well, if you need to see a physical link in order to place a higher degree of importance on something like personality, then there it is. You know, there's definitely a physical link there. And, you know, things like, you know, dopamine or serotonin or things like that that are going on in the brain are going to have physical effects. And maybe paying attention to a lifter's personality is the way that you can see into that. Now, I think there's also a learned dimension to this, and, you know, different things like the ways that you cope with stress are going to affect it. And those can be learned to an extent. You know, if you're naturally a person who's really high in neuroticism and feels lots of anxiety all the time, you can learn some strategies that will help reduce that. I don't know, and I'm really outside of my scope here, but I don't know if you can learn strategies that would reduce that to the level of someone who is just naturally low in anxiety, but you can affect it to a degree. So you should take care of those things in the way that you can take care of them. But one thing that I always come back to is that training has to be tailored to fit the lifter. It can't work if it's the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think to your point too about some of those areas of personality types and what can be some learned behavior and stuff too, I think I've talked with a few lifters about also approaching it as, you know, there are some areas of personality and mentality and things that I think it's important to try and push yourself to grow in a certain direction. And at the same time, all of those have their own sets of strengths. And I think sometimes in powerlifting, we have a tendency to always think like weakness, weakness, weakness. How do we fix the weakness? And sometimes it's like you identify a lifter has some strengths where it's like, well, let's build on these strengths. And I think sometimes you see that with personality too, of there may be some things that maybe it don't lend itself to some certain types of training, but it really lends itself to some areas that we can build on as coaches.
Yeah, I definitely see that. Anytime a topic like this comes up, invariably there will be somebody in the audience that says something along the lines of, well, what's the best personality for powerlifting?
Yeah.
And that's such an uninteresting question to me. One, because there's probably no answer to it, but just that you're going to be limited in how much you can affect those things. And yeah, you should try to affect them in a way, in the ways that you can, in the ways that you want, and for the good. But at some point, you've got to play the hand you're dealt. And, you know, if let's say that we're able to figure out that you're just really low in extroversion, and we know that low extroversion people tend to prefer shorter training sessions and lower training volumes and things like that. And let's say that we're able to figure out that that's best for people who are low in extroversion, you know, well, higher training volumes tend to, you know, net you better results on the, like the population whole, you know? So if you're trying to push ever higher training volumes, you know, in the face of your low extroversion, then that maybe isn't the best for you. You know, the interesting question to me isn't so much, you know, what's the best personality for powerlifting, or this came up with the other experiment we did with the 80% rep test. You know, well, would you rather score high reps or low reps with 80%? Like, well, you're going to score what you're going to score. And the interesting part after is what happens after that. What can you do to make the training the most effective that you can for yourself or your lifters? You know, that's the harder question, and frankly, the more interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I think I've seen this a lot too with, I feel like there's always a kind of people tugging at two ends of the spectrum of the benefits of training in a large like group or training crew versus training alone. And I think all of us would agree that there's benefits to both. But for the longest time, my first, you know, 5 or 6 years of competing, I always trained in a big training crew. And there was definitely elements of that where I saw some benefits that I think even as somebody who's introverted or high anxiety or doesn't necessarily lend itself to that type of environment, I think there's benefits to putting yourself in an uncomfortable position sometimes because you learn some great things. But I think you've seen it, and I know you train alone a lot too. I think I've even with lifters I've coached too, you just see some lifters that just end up being in a way better groove when they're able to train alone. And to your point too about the programming side of it, I think, you know, not going too far to one end of the spectrum of obviously there's general principles that apply to everyone of not everyone is, you know, whatever, special snowflake,
sure,
or whatever. But at the
sure
same time, you know, I think that's one of the downsides to when you get a large group of people that they're all completely different and they're all trying to just follow the same training is there's so many nuances with certain of those things where, you know, I know, say, when I used to do Circumax training cycles before a meet, which are brutal, you know, I would have a couple training partners that were very similar strength level to me and were like the same size, like a lot of similar variables. And we would do the exact same cycle pre-meet. And, you know, two of us would recover fine. The other three would basically just be overtrained. And we almost did the exact same thing. And I think you see, in hindsight, I've seen how a lot of people's mental and psychological approaches to those things really affected that, and it's been interesting to see more of that, and as more time goes on.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem, right? Like, how do you follow an individualized approach if your training is necessarily in a group setting? Like, let's say that, you know, you're a strength coach and you're working with a football team. You know, like, man, how do you begin to untangle that mess and try to make this individualized? You know, I mean, to me, I think the answer is you do the best you can. You know, first you move the big rocks and then you start worrying about the smaller ones, you know. You try to make sure that people have the right doses of training and then, you know, kind of peel back the layers from there. But, I mean, it's a tough problem to solve. But I think the best training practices tend to come from individualized settings, and then they get generalized into more group settings. You know, I mean, as far as like speaking specifically of powerlifters, if I like having training partners, you know, I wish I was in a situation where I had training partners more often. If you're in a situation where you do train with a crew, I still think that there's things that you can do to individualize that, to make it so that your training doesn't have to suffer as a result of you training in a group. So I live here in Colorado Springs now, and I was going down to a local gym, and for a while there was, we weren't really like a group in the sense that, you know, we definitely weren't doing the same programs. We were just all lifters, and we tended to have sessions at the same time, and you know, so we're in there together, you know, but everybody's doing their own program. You know, one person's deadlifting, another person's doing safety bar squats, and, you know, just all different things. But it was kind of a nice atmosphere that when one person would do a set, everybody else kind of does the group thing, right? As you cheer them on, you coach them, and you offer whatever advice you can. And so I thought that was really ideal to me, you know, in that everybody can still process their training in the way that they see, the way that they see fit. They can go about it in the way that they see as being the best way. And you can still kind of derive the benefits of being in a group, and, you know, just the motivational factors and the external stimulus, the, like having people coach your lifts and things like that, you know, you get a lot of those benefits without having the drawbacks of being shoehorned into one given program.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's almost kind of where, you know, you kind of, it's like the pendulum swings back and forth of, I think you have, you know, one end of the spectrum where a lot of people would train in groups and kind of all try to do the same program and see the downsides of that. And then I think you see a lot of people who have figured out the benefits of this individualized approach. And then, you know, as you just kind of mentioned, I think the optimal kind of meets somewhere in the middle. If you can get with the right training partners where you can get the support, the cueing, the objective perspective, this, you know, encouragement, but you also utilize all those individual aspects to your training, I think is a way to go. And it kind of comes back to what we talked about in the beginning of this, you know, autoregulation is course correcting the base plan. And I think if you get a good group of people together that all have good base plans, and then you can all help each other navigate those little corrections and righting the ship, I think you're in a good spot.
Yeah. You know, when I was first getting into coaching, really, there was kind of a common mantra, I guess, that you can't get to the highest levels of powerlifting. You can't reach your potential training by yourself. You have to have a crew. And I'm glad that that has shifted over the years, you know. But I will say that as a guy who's trained by myself for most of my lifting career, you know, I've had stints of having training partners here and there, but most of my time has been by myself in the basement. You know, that is a lot of time to spend by yourself in the basement. And after a while, you've listened to all the music you can listen to, and, you know, you've been alone with your thoughts as long as you can be. And I think that's good. And in a lot of ways, therapeutic, especially if that's something that you don't get exposed to very much. But it can also get boring if you let it run long enough. So I think there's a happy medium somewhere in there. And the happy medium, I mean, obviously, is going to depend on the person. If you're a high extroversion person, you need that external stimulus, you need that social connection, then you need to train in a place that offers it. And if you get overwhelmed easily by that type of social connection, then you need to avoid it. But most people fall somewhere in the middle, so you're going to need to arrange your system so that you can have the right mix for yourself.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think those are some great things for people to critically think about as they analyze their own training and programming, and then just their whole approach to powerlifting in general. You know, as much as, you know, there's obviously the downsides to so much information and social media and things, that's one of the benefits is we have all these different training concepts now, and now we can see how they can connect together. Mike, for people who would like to learn more about what you do at RTS and some of the things we talked about, where can they go to find that?
Well, probably the best place is reactivetrainingsystems.com. We have our articles there, but something that I'm really proud of, we've been building this suite of online tools. It kind of all focuses currently around a training log. So there's an online training log, and this is free for anybody to use. So online training log is obviously a place where you go to log your training. But we've added to that workout planning tools, reporting, body weight tracking. There's a recovery tracking tool. There's all these other tools, and it's all centered around helping you make smart training decisions to help you put the right weight on the bar and lift it the right number of times. So if you can get on there and use this system, then the idea is that hopefully it can allow you to have a better plan so that the course corrections that you need to make will be hopefully smaller, and it will lead to better progress over the long term. It should help you figure out what is it that works best for you and so on. And like I said, this is free for anybody to use. Anybody that wants to use it, you just go to reactivetrainingsystems.com, you log in, you click on apps, and you're there. So that's one resource. Our YouTube channel has hundreds of videos on it now, and that's just the Reactive Training Systems YouTube channel. And then if you're interested in my thoughts personally, I'm pretty active on Facebook and Instagram, although Instagram tends to be where I dump a lot of my training footage, which is of varying interest to people, I suppose.
Hey, Instagram for me has worked out as like a nice quick training video log where I can scroll back real fast. And it's been like even if no one watches this video, it's nice to be able to, hey, what did I, you know, what was this 3 weeks ago? And you can just flip down real quick.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, man, that's probably the best ways to get in touch with me and kind of find out what we're up to.
Cool. And I'll put some of the links to those things in the post for this podcast as well. And I would definitely encourage everyone to check out some of the things Mike is doing with RTS. I know I've learned a lot just from seeing your thoughts on things, reading some of the articles and blogs. And I think there's some really good tools for, you know, much as we talked about, there's individualization with everyone's going to train a little different. But if you can have as many tools as you can to help start to form the context that you view training through, I think is the way to go. So I definitely encourage people to do that.
Awesome.
Thanks for doing this, Mike. I really appreciate the conversation. I definitely took away a lot from it, and I'm sure people listening did as well.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.